from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of what's going on at the Indiana History Center this fall.
I'll talk with author Barb Shoup about her latest novel, Looking for Jack Kerouac.
And I'll find out about a unique art show that you can listen to. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The Indiana Historical Society may have just completed its fall bicentennial train programming, but its staff has plenty of other treats in store for you this fall. Sharon Gamble invited Amy Lamb and Daniel Shockley to talk about the War of the Worlds radio play reenactment, the annual holiday author fair, why traditional acting skills aren't enough for the performers in You Are There, and much, much more.
So it feels like this fall is more action-packed than usual. Amy, how long have you been at the Historical Society? It's a long time now.
Almost 8.5 years.
Wow.
It's amazing to think. I mean, we've come so far, and the IHS is so different from when I first arrived. I actually arrived about 3 months before John Herbst, our CEO, came in, and he had the drive to make us more of a destination and a gathering place. And so, you know, over the course of my 8 years or so, we see the creation of the Indiana Experience, but also a lot of different programs feeding off of that. We have a museum theater program, which we didn't have before, that helps us out with not only the Indiana Experience, but other programs as well. We're doing more and more to reach the community and create dialogue. And it's been really exciting to see the evolution.
Daniel, how long have you been with the Historical Society?
Just shy of 7 years.
Yeah. Okay. So you've ridden the same wave that Amy has in the kind of re-envisioning how do we work with the public? And it's not that you were lacking as an organization before, but certainly it feels like more and more with each passing year there are even more programs to draw the public in three dimensions to be there in person.
Yes.
Yeah. Not just at the History Center, because we're going to talk about the bicentennial train too. But this fall, I know that one especially fun activity in the fall people look forward to is baseball playoffs, and you're celebrating baseball.
We are. You know, it's unusual for us to display original items that are not ours. However, we were contacted by Scott Tarter, who is a partner with Bose McKinney and Evans, and he has an incredible collection of Indiana and particularly Indianapolis related baseball memorabilia items. And so we are just scratching the surface with our exhibit, Hoosiers Win the Pennant, Indiana Roots of American Baseball. And one of the things that we love to do at IHS is kind of bring to light myths that may or may not be correct. You know, a lot of people talk about Abner Doubleday, the Civil War Union general, inventing baseball. But as early as the 1820s, you see books popping up in America with stick and ball games. There was a game called Rounders, which is very similar to what we know baseball as today. And so it's interesting to realize that there's a lot more to the sport than just saying, oh, you know, a bunch of Civil War soldiers started playing it. So we've got tobacco cards. Who knew that the origin of baseball cards was in advertising? A lot of people may not know that. Cigarette companies wanted to sell their product, and so they inserted these cards into it.
Do you have some of the early ones that before they were even made of paper?
You know, I'm not sure exactly what some of the items are made of because they're in the cases.
Oh, got it.
But we do have, as early as the 1870s, baseball cards and photographs. Some of the books are even earlier than that are on display.
Cool.
And so we really just love the opportunity to share a little bit of our local baseball heritage. A lot of people don't realize, you know, right where the Alexander sits now, there used to be a baseball field there. There used to be a baseball field where Methodist Hospital sits today. So, you know, you see these teams in the 1870s moving on, the Blues. There were three different iterations of the Hoosiers. And, you know, a lot of people know baseball in Indianapolis for the Indians, which is wonderful because they've been around in some way, shape, or form for more than 100 years. But you know, there's so much more to Indiana's baseball heritage, and we're proud to be able to show that in this exhibit.
So a lot of your programming this fall and in general is part of museum theater. Daniel, I'm going to have you define that for us. What is museum theater?
Museum theater is defined by many people in many different ways. For us, we have actors in costume inside exhibit spaces who portray people from Indiana's past. They portray the people who could have been in whatever particular scene it is. But we're starting now to branch out even beyond that to this Halloween. We're doing The War of the Worlds, a recreation of the Orson Welles play based on the H.G. Wells novel. And we'll be staging that on our stage with seven actors playing 24 roles. Piano player is going to be playing the music that was associated with the 1938 original production of War of the Worlds.
Mm-hmm. And actually, the anniversary is on October 30th, which will be the date of our program.
Yes.
So, and lots more afterwards. You can stay after for snacks and discussion.
As long as you're not out there panicking that the world is ending.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, as our team was doing research on this, and they sent me so much information, and part of it was the fact that the newspapers reported this mass hysteria.
Yeah.
You know, you see 38 newspapers across the country saying how it caused mass panic. That was a campaign to discredit radio because radio was starting to get a lot of advertising revenue taking away from the newspapers. And so the newspaper's goal was to make it sound like radio is irresponsible. Radio is not something that you should be giving your time and your money to. And so really there really wasn't a lot going on. The papers really sensationalized it.
And we're still here 80 some years later.
That's
yay,
right.
Radio. Nothing wrong with print journalism, by the way. But wow, how interesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Orson Welles had kind of a tarnish on his reputation for a while because of that sensationalism.
Mm-hmm. I think you see that happening with everyone, you know, everyone from politicians to heads of state to, you know, just your everyday organization. You know, a lot of things end up spinning out of control or, you know, having a lot of embellishments and that sort of thing. So I think it's a good lesson for us to continue to think about as media goes forward today with watchdog journalism and all that. You know, you really have to stick to the facts because what you say now, whether or not it's correct, might be in common knowledge history 50, 100 years later.
And if you're bringing your children to any of these events, don't tell them that they're going to get a little education. But what a healthy way to kind of talk with children about the fact that just because it's on the internet doesn't necessarily mean it's true.
Very true.
So the history train has undergone a little bit of a makeover.
It has. We actually just wrapped up our 2014 stops. We went to Columbus, Jasper, Terre Haute, and Bargersville, and thousands of people have come out to see us. And this is something that we will run for another 2 years. We'll go to the northern half of the state next fall, and then we'll wrap up with Indiana's bicentennial year in the southern half of the state, which was part of the state earlier than some of those northern counties.
Sure.
So we're really looking forward to the chance to continue through lots of different programs like the Bicentennial Train and others to get people ready to think about how they want to celebrate the bicentennial, looking back, but also looking at the present and looking forward.
Mm-hmm. And why trains in the first place?
Well, I think trains just hold a fascination for people, whether you're the age of my kids, you know, 5 and 2 and a half, they want to see trains. You know, the walking through of three renovated freight cars that hold our exhibit called The Next Indiana is really exciting for people because, you know, it's not an everyday transportation route for us, although Amtrak and several other companies are doing what they can to continue passenger rail. But a lot of us don't get up close and personal with those things. So it was also a big part of Indiana's history. You know, we are the crossroads of America, and railroads were a big part of that, too. So it's a way for us to connect with our past and with our heritage and realize that some things that we think are past really are still present with us.
Sure, absolutely. Spirit and Place Festival, you have an interesting program as part of the citywide Spirit and Place Festival.
Yes, we're very excited. Journey is the theme for Spirit and Place this year. And we thought, well, the journey to marriage might be an interesting conversation. You know, we're right in the middle of a journey to marriage for some people. And so we're going to explore that journey today, the journey 60 years ago, journey further back than that. And we'll begin that evening with museum theater. We'll do a short museum theater piece revolving around three families having essentially the same discussion many decades apart about the parent figure telling the younger person, you can't marry this person because it's just not done. What will people say? What will the neighbor say? It's not legal. And we're hoping that by starting with the museum theater piece, it will show that even in these three families, decades apart, it's the same conversation happening over and over again.
Even if the particulars are completely different.
Yes.
Yeah. What do you look for in actors who are interpreting in this kind of a setting as distinct from maybe actors you would have in a more traditional theater setting?
The in this particular setting, this is going to be a scripted play. Mm-hmm. And in our You Are There exhibits, that's all unscripted. Mm-hmm. And so in a You Are There exhibit, what you look for is someone who's not afraid to talk, someone who's not shy. You don't really need an actor's background to do that. But then when you move into the more scripted pieces like the War of the Worlds and the Will You Marry Me piece, it is helpful to have some background in theater so that you understand staging and things like that.
Sure. For the You Are There actors, where do you find, I assume you're kind of looking for people who are geeked about learning about a particular era of history and just absorbing as much as they can. How do you find those people?
It's interesting. Those people come from all over. We have probably a third of our staff are actors, professional and amateur actors here in town. But we have retired educators. We have a woman who owned her own cleaning business for 30 years.
Huh.
And we have students. And it's really interesting to see that we use the same actors over and over again. You know, if we build a grocery store, which we did many years ago, those
right.
actors then move into Prohibition, then they move into the Jewish kitchen, then they move into others. And so it's fascinating to see their learning process. It's constant. You know, we never stop researching a You Are There, even if it's up a year and a half. We have to be prepared for what the visitor wants. And sometimes that's hard to guess what the visitor wants, so we end up doing some quick research on the fly sometimes.
Have you ever been incognito in the audience, so to speak, and heard a visitor have an encounter with one of your staff members that just threw him for a loop? That just, you know, I'm picturing some 8-year-old kid who's like, I know you're just an actor. I'm going to stump you.
I have. Actually, when we did our pilot phase in 2008, we were presenting a 1945 Terre Haute grocery store. Down the block was a movie theater, and one of our characters was Helen, the usherette from the movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
We knew the movie was Roy Rogers, Hands Across the Border. I ordered it online. We watched it. And so the young lady was talking about that to an older folks,
mm-hmm.
and somebody said, is Dale Evans in that?
Uh-oh.
Well, we knew Dale Evans was not in that, but we didn't know where Dale Evans was in Roy Rogers' life at that moment in 1945.
Oh.
So that was a quick time to do some research.
Wow.
To then be able to say that, no, she's not in this. They wouldn't have known Dale Evans yet. This young lady probably would not have known Dale Evans yet.
Sure.
They had not released a film, I don't believe, at that point,
okay.
or if they had, it was very few.
The things you're not prepared for when you're going to school, things you
exactly.
encounter in your job, right?
Exactly.
Well, there's no cruise control, you know what I mean? And we sometimes add characters after something has been open for mm-hmm. a while based on, you know, maybe new storylines come to light. We might meet someone who had been there or had known one of the people who could have been in the photograph at the time. So it's an evolving process for our team as well as for the actors who are playing a part.
What a treat. And speaking of multifaceted characters, the Holiday Author Fair coming up December 6th is always full of colorful characters.
It is. You know, we will have more than 65 authors this year. We're very excited about that. And people always ask, well, who comes out to the author fair? You know, do you have the same group of authors every single time? And we actually have a system in place with a handful of exceptions. They need to have had a book that came out within the last 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always a fresh crop of people. And it's everything from nonfiction and history to biography to cookbooks. We have a lot of wonderful chefs in the state of Indiana that are sharing their recipes with us. There are children's authors, both fiction and nonfiction. And you can also go and shop in the Basile History Market. We offer complimentary gift wrapping, usually by a group that will sing for you as well. And we haven't secured our group yet for that, but we're hoping for good things. And it's just a wonderful chance to get to meet and talk with an author. You know, they're going to give you time. It's not just, here, will you personalize my book? You can ask them questions about where they got their inspiration from or what their next project might be, keeping an eye out for that. So we've got, you know, favorites like Philip Gully, as well as newcomers.
Sharon Gamble with the Indiana Historical Society's Amy Lamb and Daniel Shockley. You can learn more about the programming they discussed, as well as lots more cool events for everyone in the family, at indianahistory.org. Again, indianahistory.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Award-winning author Barb Shoup's eighth novel, Looking for Jack Kerouac, has recently been released by Lacewing Books, the young adult imprint of Engine Books. Travis DiNicola talked with Barb about the novel and her work as the executive director of the Indiana Writers' Center.
Barb, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always great to see you.
Always good to be here.
So you've got a new book, relatively new book, a book about looking for Kerouac. Which
is
kind of fun, and I want to talk about that. But I can talk about the Writers' Center as well in just a few minutes, of course. But I'm really curious about this new book of yours. Tell me about it.
Well, it is set in 1964, and I was pretty amused when I got a very nice review from one site that it began in this strong work of historical fiction, and I thought, oh my goodness, I'm old enough now to be writing historical fiction about my own adolescence, because that was my coming of age time. But I'll take it, and that was good.
I'm guessing you didn't think of this as historical fiction while you were writing
it. Well, you know, it's all relative, right? I did not. But on the other hand, if you're 18 and it is a YA novel, it would be historical fiction for you, and that is fine with me, whatever works. But the book is published by Lacewing Books, which is, and it's the first book in the new young adult imprint of Engine Books, which is here in Indianapolis. So I'm
very
thrilled about that. And both
Victoria Barrett's group,
Victoria Barrett and Andrew Scott is the Lacewing Books person. So I'm very fortunate to be working with them. The book is about a kid who falls in love with Jack Kerouac on the road when he's a senior in high school, and some things happen that are kind of traumatic to him over that year. And at the end of it, he ends up going to work in the steel mill, which is what a lot of kids did in 1964, where I grew up in the Calumet region. And he hooks up with another kid whose name is Duke Walchek. He always just makes me laugh because I had a good time writing that character. He is a character.
Uh-huh.
And so he's also a Kerouac nut. And the two of them just take off. And they, they're going to find Jack Kerouac, who they have learned lives in St. Petersburg, Florida. What they did not know is that Jack Kerouac lived there with his mother and that he was pretty much of a mess by that time in his life. And so, of course, the hero that they're looking for is a disappointment. So I then had to find something else to happen that would resolve all of my character's, Paul's, issues. And I did that. It was a very interesting process. I was not so much a Kerouac fan myself, but many of your listeners will know Skip Barry, who's a terrific writer here in town. And the idea was originally his. And he told it to me one day a long while ago. And I sort of jokingly said, so if you ever don't want that, could I use it? And he said, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of years ago, he said, I'm not going to use it. And so he gave it to me. Thanks, Skip. And I did.
Huh.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. So it's got a bit of a story behind it.
I imagine in writing this, it had to be a challenge to imagine Kerouac and to write write Kerouac as a character in this book.
It was a little daunting because he is an icon of American literature. And so I found him to be a very, very interesting and complex person. I did a lot of research. I read and read and read. I read everything he wrote, and I read all of the memoirs and whatever I could get my hands on. And I watched TV clips, which were interesting to watch mm-hmm. and listen to his voice. He had a wonderful voice.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as time went on and I felt that I was getting to know him better and better, he was a much different person than I thought he would be. And he doesn't really enter the book until pretty near the end when he gets found by my character. And I worried that people who were Kerouac fans mm-hmm. might not like the Kerouac that I had made, because I was honest to what happened to him in those last years, and it wasn't pretty. But I also found that there was a great tenderness in him and a lot of other traits that I really loved. And so I was very, very gratified when my friend Dan Wakefield, who knew Kerouac a little bit, sent the book to a friend of his named David Amram, who lives in New York and was a close friend of Kerouac's. And David sent back a note that said that he liked the book very much and he felt that I had captured Kerouac. So far, that's the best thing that's happened to me. And I get a lot of great reviews, and I hope that I do, but probably nothing will mean quite that much to me as that.
Yeah. Well, I can only imagine that was a very daunting task.
It was. Interesting, though, and I really enjoyed it.
So, I mean, this is a young adult book that you've written, and, you know, a lot of people say about, especially On the Road, maybe even more so than any of Kerouac's books, that sort of best read when you are a young adult.
It certainly appeals to young people and has ever since it was published. It's a young person's book, for sure. I mean, there's not a shred of maturity in it.
Was that weird? I mean, going back to On the Road, you know, as older than young adult, Barb?
I didn't really think much about On the Road, to tell you the truth. Yeah. It's not a book that I particularly like, and I didn't particularly like it as a young person either. Although
an 18-year-old boy when you read it.
That is true, although a lot of women liked it, too, as young people. So I didn't really think that much about the book when I was writing it, other than when I was first starting, I kind of played with the first sentences of On the Road, trying to find a voice into it, which I didn't keep in the end, but it did sort of launch me into the voice that I eventually used.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Very cool. It sounds like just a delightful read.
Well, I hope so. Yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of adults find it appealing, too. And, you know, there's a lot of this sort of interesting, not exactly controversy, but chit-chat mm-hmm. about the whole YA genre. And some people think that if you're an adult, you shouldn't read it because it's some sign of not being smart enough or something, which personally I feel is ridiculous. They're coming-of-age stories. Yeah. And, you know, that's a time-honored, you know, genre of fiction over many, many years. And so if you like those kinds of stories, and if the story is well written and it has some depth, which I hope and think mine does, I think it's appealing to adults as well, especially adults my age, you know, the baby boomers, because it brings that time back.
Well, and as you said, it's set in 64, right?
Set in 1964.
Very good.
A very interesting year, as it turns out. I didn't quite know that living it, but when I went back and, you know, I was however old, but when I went back and researched it, I was really interested and kind of surprised in a way to see how many things.
Happened.
It was such a hinge year. It was a hinge year in a lot of ways.
Well, that's what writing a historical novel will do for you there.
Yep, there you go. You got this perspective, you know, that you didn't have then.
So, Barb, when you are not writing novels, you are the director of the Writers Center Writers Center of Indianapolis.
Indiana. Writers Center of Indiana. Yep.
Writers Center of Indiana. tell me about the Writers Center, what's going on there, because I know you guys have some upcoming events.
Oh, we've always got wonderful things going on at the Indiana Writers Center. Coming up right away is, well, not right away, but within a few weeks, is a free program on writing and publishing that we're doing as part of the celebration of the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Author Awards.
Excellent, yeah.
Yeah, and the Indiana Authors Fair. It'll be at Central Library on Saturday, October the 25th from 10 to 5. So on that day, Nancy Baxter will be giving a keynote address on all the trends in publishing and getting people up to date on what's what and how to think about various options in publishing, marketing, and all those kinds of things. She has spent ages researching, so she's got some great up to date information for people on that. And then we'll have sessions on a variety of kinds of writing by lots of really good Indiana writers, and some of those sessions are mystery, speculative fiction, Western fiction, memoir, creative nonfiction, humor, and writing for children. Mm-hmm. Rebecca K. Dotlitch and I will be offering writing workshops for children and for young adults around noontime. So you can go to the IMCPL library site and find that event. So I hope that lots of people will show up for that. It's a terrific event. And as I said, it's free. So, you know, if you're thinking about getting started or you're started and you don't know what to do with what you've got or you're stuck, it's a great place to get some information.
And inspiration.
And inspiration, absolutely.
And that's all on October 25th?
October 25th from 10 to 5.
What do you have going on after that?
Well, actually, a little bit before that, the same sort of running up to that weekend, also free with a small charge for pizza, is a free workshop and reading for teen readers and teen writers with Patricia Hanley and Elizabeth Stuckey French, the co-authors of a brand new YA book, also published by Lacewing Books, just out, that's called Where Wicked Starts. Patricia Henley and Elizabeth Stuckey French are both Indiana writers with very wonderful creds as, quote, adult writers. And they have they're good friends, and they thought that it would be fun to try this YA novel. And it's absolutely wonderful. Both of them are award-winning writers. Both of them are wonderful teachers. And so they will be offering this workshop. It is the 24th, the day before the publishing workshop at the Writers' Center from 5:30 to 8 p.m. So if you're a teen writer or if you know of a teen who's interested in writing, please check this program out. And there are just 15 places in the class. The reading's open to more than that, but just 15 places in the class. So give us a call and
The
Writers'
Center
now.
Is up in Broad Ripple.
The Writers' Center is on the campus of the Indiana Arts Center, Indianapolis Arts Center.
Very good. So, and of course, I mean, you offer lots of workshops.
We've got lots of classes coming up in the next few weeks. Branding Secrets for Writers, Creative Nonfiction, Flash Fiction. Those are all in October. And then we've got in November, Poetry Boot Camp, World Building, When Fiction Meets Fact, and various other kinds of interesting classes and workshops coming up. So you can check those out by going to our website, www.indianawriters.org. And for those of you who may be involved in Writers' Center events and may be wondering about our annual gathering of writers, we have changed that to the spring. So mark your date for March 21st. We haven't gotten everybody organized for it yet, but we will be doing that shortly. So watch for news about that. And it's going to be at the Indiana Landmarks, which is such a great venue for anything.
Barbara, let me ask you, you are very much in touch with both emerging as well as established writers here in Indianapolis and throughout Indiana. And you've been a part of this writers community here for quite a long time. It seems to me that lately there's just, I don't know if there's more writers or we're getting more attention for the writers or writers from Indiana are having more success, but it seems as though there's just a lot going on right now in the writers' community.
There's a lot of energy, isn't there?
Yeah, there
is. It's pretty exciting. And I
mean,
you
do you see that from your side?
I definitely see it. Yeah. And I think that one of the things that I love about the Writers' Center is that it is a community of writers, and it gets people together who have an interest in that. And we also let people know by way of our weekly e-blast about other things that are going on. Lots of stuff's going on at Indy Reads, and so that is a tremendous source of energy. I mean, we tend to be more class and workshop-oriented.
Sure.
You guys at Indy Reads are doing these great events that we can, you know, kind of help by promoting, and a lot of our instructors read and do workshops for you. So, there's great stuff going on, and there are some programs for young people at Butler and University of Indianapolis in the summer. So,
and we talked about the library a bit with
the library,
Eugene Merrill.
Yes, and we do we do a series of classes, free classes for IMCPL as well, and those will be coming up in November after the Authors Day.
But then you look at Victoria Barrett and Engine Books and what they're doing, and then you've got great writers that are living here that are getting national attention, whether it's Ben Winters or John Green, and of course having Dan Wakefield back in town is awesome.
Yes, yeah, great having Dan back.
Really,
he's teaching for us, which we love.
Cool. It seems
he's
like a really great time right now.
It's a great time for Indianapolis writers. It really is. There's a lot going on.
Travis DiNicola with author Barb Shoup. Her latest book, Looking for Jack Kerouac, is available now at local bookstores. For more information, visit BarbaraShoup.com, Barbara, SHOUP.com. Thank you. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
I have something unusual on today's calendar that we call...
What do we do? What would that be?
Well, to warm up for the events we're going to tell you about, I want you to go to your safe, secure website, WFYI.org. That's your portal to everything you hear here on WFYI. Or call 1-800-233-0020 to renew your membership, become a new member, or make an additional gift.
Absolutely. And it's a perfect time to do it if you're calling on Thursday night. We're still wrapping up the pledge. If you're calling Saturday morning, okay, technically the pledge drive wrapped up Friday night, but you can still make your call Saturday
morning. We won't tell.
It's totally okay.
Yeah, it's okay because you're our friend and you're our listener.
And do us a favor and let them know how much you like a local art show with long format interviews, because
Absolutely.
There's nothing else like it. And
Not
your support thing. Makes it happen.
Absolutely. WFYI.org, 1-800-233-0020. Thank you so much if you've already done your public broadcasting duty. And if you haven't, it's not too late. We appreciate it.
There we go. Hey, some quick things on our calendar. I just want to remind people that Jonathan Franzen, who is an amazing author, is going to be at Butler next week, October 28th, at Clues Memorial Hall, 7:30. It's their Writer's Harvest event. He's a National Book Award winner and Pulitzer Prize finalist. I loved his book, Freedom. Go hear him, Jonathan Franzen, on the 28th.
Awesome. Butler. Speaking of Butler, Butler University Visual Arts Professor Gautam Rao has a show that goes from November 7th through November 28th at the Raymond James Stutz Art Gallery at the Stutz Center. And it's called Color Coded, and it's an exploration of contrast between image and text, analog and digital methods, and analytical and aesthetic thinking. Very thought-provoking. So check that out this November.
Very cool. Hey, some great jazz shows taking place at the Jazz Kitchen this weekend. Friday night, Ferez Whitted, awesome trumpeter, mm-hmm. is having a CD release party on Friday. And then on Saturday, Acoustic Alchemy is going to be coming to Indianapolis. They are a triple Grammy nominated group, a duo, really fantastic music, just fun stuff. And those concerts are at the Jazz Kitchen Friday and Saturday.
Dr. Jim Glass is back with another free talk. This one's coming up on November 10th. It's a Monday night at 7 o'clock. It'll be at the Riviera Club Ballroom. And the talk is called Architecture in Greece and Turkey. Copious amounts of great photos and stories to help you understand what we in Indianapolis owe to ancient architecture in Greece and Turkey.
Very cool. Hey, Sharon, you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. And of course, we'll be back next week with more things on that calendar that we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Visual artist Pete Brown had such a great time partnering with Bosma Enterprises on Visualize Without Your Eyes a few years ago that he's cooked up a new show, Art on Music. Pete and Bosma Enterprises' Lisa Pace gave Sharon Gamble this sneak preview, complete with sample art.
Art on Music.
Yes.
You sure you have that in the right order? It's not Music on Art.
No, it's
okay.
not.
Okay, Art
it's
on
not.
Music.
Absolutely.
Where did the idea of this collaboration come from?
Well, long before I was doing visual art, my first creative love was music. And so, I started in third grade playing trombone and eventually evolved and changed into guitars and being in bands and rock bands and traveling around and performing, you know. So as soon as I got into doing more contemporary visual art, in the back of my mind, I've always had this dream of doing an art show where the canvases were functional musical instruments.
And partnering with Bosma seems just about perfect.
Oh, absolutely. You know, since we had our first partnership, major partnership in 2012 with the tactile exhibition, Visualize Without Your Eyes, we've you know, kind of been stewing, and I think we've all been simmering on what are we going to do next that's going to allow people to touch artwork and
sure.
pick up artwork and hold it and use other senses besides sight to experience the type of work that people are creating.
Lisa, tell me about your relationship to art. What's the place of art in your life? What has it been? Do you think it's evolved at all?
I currently have lost most of my usable vision, but as a youth, I did have pretty normal vision, and so I was exposed to the arts. My parents would take me to museums. I took ballet lessons, and as I lost my vision, I became sort of disconnected from that world. It wasn't until we did the art exhibit with Pete that I was once again introduced to art in a way that I hadn't been since I lost my vision, and it really just opened my eyes to there was other ways to experience this wonderful medium. So
I feel like we maybe should recap what that exhibit, how it worked, what it was comprised of for listeners who have slept in the last couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. In 2012, I was fortunate enough to partner with Bahasma and create a tactile art exhibition with the Arts Council in their space gallery, 924. And we had over 40 pieces of art, and every visitor was encouraged to touch the art and experience it with their hands as well as their eyes. And you know, it was an attempt to broaden Bosma's reach into the community. You know, something really interesting about Bosma I was sharing the other day is that they're celebrating 100 years next
year. Oh, my gosh,
year.
I had no idea.
Absolutely.
Congratulations.
Yeah. I mean, a century
That's a
they've
big
been
deal.
Here. Yeah.
It is, especially for a not-for-profit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to say, you know what, they were really interested in getting their mission out into new avenues, and what a better place to be unexpected, you know, for an organization that serves people with visual impairments than an art gallery, right?
Sure.
Because we all learn, don't touch anything.
Right.
Only look. So in a traditional environment, what is there to experience if you can't use your vision,
right.
you know?
And our mission is creating opportunities for people who are blind or visually impaired, and that's all opportunities from employment to going to an art exhibit and being able to touch the art. Experience
Absolutely.
It that way.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you have some fellow artists
yes.
who are contributing to this. How did you find colleagues to other artists who might get this idea and have it resonate with them?
Yeah, well, originally I was watching my friends and colleagues on Facebook, and what I realized as a pattern was so many artists would go into the studio in the afternoon or the evening, and they'd say, oh, I'm turning on Counting Crows, turning on Skrillex, mm-hmm. turning on, you know, Jay-Z. And everybody was talking about what music they were you know, listening to while they were creating.
Sure.
And it just seemed to start to gel, you know. And so I started reaching out to a wide assortment of friends and colleagues I've made over the years that I know are really inspired by music, that took note and interest when we did the last exhibition, and I knew would be up for the challenge of creating on a new canvas and creating with touch in mind.
Sure.
And one artist that you've worked with, Pete, is John Bramblett, who mm-hmm. And did a guitar for this particular exhibit.
Yeah, absolutely. John Bramblett in Denton, Texas is mm-hmm. Blind as well, and mm-hmm. he's doing a guitar, and that's it's awesome. It's really awesome to see how many folks around the country are considering these things, and really how really fresh and new it still is here.
Absolutely.
That there are established artists creating tactile work
yeah.
or visually impaired artists that can be involved. So
John was on this program a year or so ago, and he talked a little bit about his experiments as he was losing his ability to differentiate colors, how he figured out, well, if I can get some texture into different textures into the different colors in my paint palette, I'll know this one here is blue, this one here is purple, so they're very close. I can't see the difference anymore, but I can feel the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
fascinating. I'm going to have you hand this piece back to Lisa.
Okay.
Pete, as always, I love that you bring pieces onto a radio show that our listeners can't see, but it's so appropriate in this particular instance. Lisa's first exposure to this piece was a couple moments before we turned on the microphones, but tell us about your experience of this piece of art.
Well, the first thing is the smell. It has a new smell to it, so that makes it interesting to me. It makes me want to pick up and touch it and feel whether it's square, whether it has angles, whether it has curves. by feeling it, I can also tell whether what it's made of is wood. I can also tell that some of it feels like it's metal.
Mm-hmm.
I can also, the piece has pieces that move, which make it additionally interesting. And so I don't have to see it anymore. I can feel it. I can smell it. I can imagine the colors.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a different experience than when I was having a visual experience with art.
Sure. Is there a, do you intuit a particular instrument as you're exploring it?
I would say it was something that had a neck. So this is something that probably you tune with.
Mm-hmm.
And is that what it is?
It is, absolutely.
So I don't know what instrument it belongs to, but I love it. I love to be able to touch it. And not the same experience I had as a child when my parents would take me to a museum and would tell me not to touch.
Exactly. So, stay behind the velvet ropes.
So this is a really, I think, beautiful exhibit for people to bring their children to, and mm-hmm. it is open to the public. So a great way for kids to experience art and be able to touch.
So, Pete, this was a piece you created.
It was, yeah. It is, yeah.
There's a portion of an instrument incorporated into this piece.
Yes.
As a musician as well as a visual artist,
mm-hmm.
did you have a moment where you said, I can't cut up this instrument? Or did you buy instruments that were already in pieces so you didn't have to face that?
Well, we have another great sponsor besides Bosma, which is SHS International, and they've provided us with a diverse assortment of their A stock, which is the stuff you'd see on the shelves, mm-hmm. all the way down to stuff that you might as well throw on a fire.
Oh.
So a lot of these I didn't have to cut up myself. I did cut up a few and would post photos on Facebook, and all my friends would cringe and curse me out for destroying an instrument. But it's been really fun to play with the parts and the components. And we actually have a couple of artists that are incorporating building Frankenstein art, you know, out of different parts of different things that we were able to kind of scavenge from SHS. And so it'll be really interesting to see what folks do.
Kind of like the old-fashioned one-man band contraptions where there's a
Absolutely.
Keyboard and something you blow into and all that kind of stuff. Does this piece have a name, Pete?
It doesn't yet. I'm still working on giving it a title. But Lisa was right on. It is a broken headstock off of a banjo. So
she might be able to help you name it.
There you go. We'll name it Lisa.
I think you should.
You and Steve Jobs. Okay. So speaking of the stories behind these pieces, in a side enterprise that's perfectly organically connected to this, Pete, you've developed something called Piggyback.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
I developed Piggyback out of a real need that I was seeing in the cultural organizations, not only in Indianapolis, but with colleagues I was meeting with and talking to around the country. And that need is being able to reach out to audiences through the mobile platform.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of folks, you know, there's expense that goes along with developing apps or hiring people to do that. And so I really wanted to facilitate kind of a community hub where folks that wanted to reach audiences through their mobile devices and tablets could realistically get together and share content. And so that's what we're incorporating for this exhibition as well. And in our case, Art on Music will be using it as kind of a really hyped up audio tour. So if you remember the days of going to a museum and picking up the little device, people are going to be able to use their phones to get behind the scenes information. But not only audio, it's video, audio, images, text. And, you know, we're using it for event registration. So folks that come to our public programs can register for events through there, buy tickets right through the app. There's turn-by-turn directions to the Soul Center. So when you're driving down, you can access all of that right through the app as well.
It's like a one-stop shop.
It is. And it's been I feel very fortunate to see so many different organizations locally using it for a wide variety of reasons. Some folks that are using it to share their mission and their upcoming programs, other folks that are using it as an educational outreach piece for distance learning. So it's really neat. It's a template is the easiest way to describe it, and then folks can log in and use it however they see fit.
So talk to me about years ago when you were first a visual artist, you didn't have the opportunity to be there with the people experiencing your art. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, there would be those rather formal labels mm-hmm. that are on the wall that people might be able to read, or maybe the old school audio tour read the label.
Yeah.
What does it change for you in your work and how you approach your art to know that you've got this personal digital curator at your beck and call?
Yeah, no, it's a whole nother tool. You know, it's a whole nother tool I can incorporate and I can consider when I'm creating. And I really have Bosma to thank for that as well, because the first show really inspired this. It inspired all of this to happen. I'm very thankful to Bosma. You know, for the first exhibition, I had a great group of folks, and Lisa was on that panel, that I would come to and just talk to, and I would bring samples and materials and test sheets, if you remember from our last meeting, and just get their feedback. And one thing I learned a lot about was descriptive audio, saying, how do you describe a piece of art to someone who can't necessarily see it, as opposed to how you or I might be able to perceive it? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's really just another tool. It's another tool to hear directly from the artist's mouth what that piece is about. You don't need an interpreter, you don't need a guide, and you don't need to read 10 pages of text on a wall.
You don't have to go to school.
Yeah.
Do you think some of you and some of your fellow artists might get as far as saying, please come and touch this piece, run your hand over the board at the back of it, or you know, really explicit descriptions? Lisa, are you anticipating being able to do that?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And want to echo what Pete said, is it really gives you an enhanced version of a typical gallery tour, because you do get to hear from the artist and you get to touch and play and almost put your hands in it as the artist has. So it's very exciting.
And I hate the idea of these stories being lost. You know, that was something I experienced during my time in arts administration, was we had such a robust artist in residence program, and folks didn't necessarily know what to do. You know, we wanted to hear stories. We wanted to share that with the public. But how do we capture that, and how do we get that out easily, affordably, and keep those stories? Because, I mean, anybody would love to talk to Michelangelo today.
That's what I'm thinking. If we could get in the time machine and take Piggyback back and know more.
Yep.
But for someone who's blind, it's everything to be able to have that audio description and, again, be with the artist as they made the piece. Just something you wouldn't typically get at a visual art exhibit. So it's so exciting.
Pete, I want to ask you about you, because you brought another piece of art that will be in this exhibition. Can you tell us about, I think you said the name a little bit ago.
Absolutely, yeah. This is a finished, fantastic piece by Christina Hollering, who is local to Indianapolis. She has a studio with some friends at the Murphy Building called Two Thirds. And this piece really blew me away for a couple of reasons. First off, Christina's work generally is very multi-layered and textural, and you want to touch it, you know. And I own a couple of her pieces, which are great pieces in my home. But there's always glass over the top, you know. And I think that's something that she really pondered and thought about when she was making this work, because this piece, which depicts a rabbit, and again, you can go to Piggyback and hear her talk about this, but it looks like a rabbit skeleton kind of digging or floating through an abyss, sort of. But, you know, she really took the full opportunity and took the full mission of the challenge of this show, and really made it a beautiful piece that's totally functional and playable, you know, which is really neat. So people can come and explore it. They can take it off the wall and play it and hopefully take it home with them.
And the feel of it is amazing. It has a lot of texture, a lot of depth.
Yeah.
The bunny is almost a Day of the Dead bunny. His skeleton is kind of an exoskeleton, but he's beautiful, and he's perched on a lovely guitar.
Yeah, and the story behind it's great, and I'm not going to tell it, because I want people to go hear it for themselves on Piggyback.
Stay tuned. We'll tell you how to do that. Thank you so much, and break a leg with this exhibit. Don't take that literally.
Thank you. Hope to see you there, and thanks again for the
Thank
offer.
Thank you.
Sharon Gamble with artist and entrepreneur Pete Brown and Bosma Enterprises' Lisa Pace. Art on Music features works by 18 artists from 7 states, and all the works feature musical instruments. and nearly all the instruments can be played. See Art on Music November 1st through the 15th at the Saul Center, 708 East Michigan Street. There's an opening reception on November 1st and special programming during the run of the exhibit. Learn more at bosma.org/artonmusic. Again, that's bosma.org/artonmusic. And find all about the Piggyback mobile app at piggyback-app.com. That's piggyback-app.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll meet some of the poets who have had their work featured at the new Eskenazi Hospital.
I'll get a preview of this year's Spirit and Place Festival.
And I'll find out what's new at the Indiana Ballet Conservatory. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.